Oh, we don't do it like this at Summerbourne, he would say. And then, I saw your ex down the feathers again last night. Had a nice chat with him. He couldn't remember your name.
Don't listen to him, love, Mum told me afterward. He's just not used to you growing up yet. Just don't go on too much about this Summerbourne, yeah? It gets his back up. I spent most of the fortnight in my old bedroom. My Bon Jovi posters had been peeled off the walls, and Beaky's boxes of duty-free wine took up most of the floor space. But my bed was still there, with my swimming trophies lined up along the shelf above it. I sat cross-legged on the bed with my textbooks open, wondering if my ex-boyfriend remembered shoving me out the door, calling me an attention-seeking bitch. He was the total opposite of Alex. My thoughts drifted frequently to the way Alex looked at me when he asked me about myself, and the way he listened to me, with a half-smile forming. I wondered whether he would come back to Summerbourne, and whether he knew yet about Ruth's pregnancy. I thought about Ruth on the beach saying, he'd love to have children of his own, of course. My notes grew dimpled with tears. On Christmas morning, I hid in that room to unwrap my presents from the Mays family. A beautifully soft lamb's wool scarf with matching gloves from Ruth and Dominic, and a dress book from Vera, and a box of chocolates from Edwin. Mum cooked a turkey with roast potatoes and chipolatas, but my stomach was unsettled all day, and I could only pick at the meal and duck away from Beaky's permanent glare. My birthday 2 days after Christmas was uneventful. Mum gave me a book and some pyjamas that were too small for me. My friends were all busy, and I hadn't mentioned the date to the Mays family. I read my new book in my room and munched my way through the chocolates. When Patty, Joe, and Hazel called by a couple of days later, I told them I was too unwell to come out. I didn't feel like explaining Summerbourne to anyone else, and I didn't relish hearing about their new lives either. Returning to Summerbourne was like waking from a bad dream. I travelled back on New Year's Eve, or Old Year's Night, as they called it in the village, so that I could look after Edwin while Ruth and Dominic attended a party at Kemi and Chris Harris's house. I felt as though I ought to be paying them for having me back, rather than the other way around. Edwin danced around me in the hall as Dominic paid the taxi driver behind me.
Laura, I got a red bike from Father Christmas. Can we go out and play?
The last day of the year was cold and grey, and the interior of the house offered a warm welcome, but I was desperate to wash my lungs out with fresh Summerbourne coastal air.
Get your coat on then, quick, I said,
and we took his new bike out for a tour around the garden, giggling at his wobbly progress and delighting in being reunited. After Ruth and Dominic had left for the party and Edwin had fallen asleep, I wandered around the sitting room and browsed through the family's Christmas cards. There must have been over 100, arranged along the mantelpiece, the bookshelves, the sideboard. Eventually, I found one from Alex. Have a great Christmas, it said. Hope to see you in the new year. He won the prize for the blandest message. I turned up the volume on the television in the sitting room and listened to Big Ben strike midnight with my face pressed against the window in the hall, watching fireworks explode over the village. The Luckhursts were close neighbours of the Harrises, and I suspected that both Joel and Ralph would still be up, enjoying the celebrations with their parents. I was glad Edwin was safely tucked up asleep in his bed. Happy Old Year's Night, I whispered to the darkness. A lone ball of light flared and swooped in a downward arc, leaving a trail like a silver scar in the sky. I was tempted to make a wish, as if it were a falling star. But it was just a firework. And anyway, I didn't know whether to wish that Alex would come back, or that he wouldn't.
19. Seraphine. Joel knocks on my bedroom door early on Friday morning and carries a mug of coffee into my bedside table. I've been awake for a while, mulling over last night's conversation, and I wish now I'd got up sooner and brushed my hair, put on something more attractive than this old grey T-shirt of Edwin's that I adopted because it's so comfortable. I pull my sheet closer to my chin, and he smiles down at me.
I have to go check on Michael before I go to work. You're going to be okay till Edwin and Danny get here?
I nod.
Be careful, he says. Ring me if you need me.
He pauses at the door on his way out.
Oh, and you look gorgeous, by the way.
The coffee is the perfect temperature, and I smile into it. But as the caffeine sharpens my thoughts, I am struck by the certain knowledge that Michael does have a key to Summerbourne. When Edwin still lived here before he moved into Winterbourne, he lost his key at the beach one weekend. He joked afterward that he'd been preparing to survive on the fruits of the greenhouse until I got home, cursing his bad luck that none of the usual doors or windows had been left unlocked. But in the end, he said, he'd jumped the wall by the stable block and walked down to Michael's cottage, and Michael had produced a huge set of assorted keys, one of which had opened Summerbourne's front door. Because they trusted him, I told myself. Dad or Vera or Mum, one of them must have given Michael a key at some point because they trusted him. It might even have come from Vera's parents. Vera celebrates her 75th birthday next year, and I would guess Michael to be 10 years older. He might have been living in that cottage, working for Vera's parents long before Vera inherited the house. The old village postmaster once told me my great-grandparents threw scandalous parties here during the fabulous 50s. Naked dancing on the beach, he told me. Babies conceived under cloaks around the campfire. Eerie singing from the top of the folly. No wonder Summerbourne has never shrugged off its reputation for being a world apart from the rest of the village. I try to picture Michael Harris watching me drive away from Summerbourne on Monday, shuffling down the lane, letting himself in, climbing the stairs, writing with lipstick on the mirror. I throw off my sheet and head for the shower. It's beyond ridiculous. Joel has left me a note on the kitchen table. Eat breakfast. I blast some instant porridge in the microwave and force it down. Then I push my lurking anxieties to the back of my mind and concentrate on scrubbing the kitchen and running the vacuum cleaner around the ground floor. I don't need to rely on Vera remembering to send in cleaners. I throw open every window and all of the back doors, and the fresh sea breeze clears the stale air from the house. Until last month, my solitude at Summerbourne was interrupted regularly by visits from Dad. If Edwin came with me, he and Dad would happily spend a Sunday morning preparing a roast dinner, and if Vera joined us, we would shake out the old red tablecloth and make an event of it. Danny spends the odd week here too, in between overseas volunteering projects. He makes popcorn when I get in from work, and we binge-watch old movies together. But I rarely have other visitors. Perhaps I don't feel the same need for friends that other people do. Outside my family, the only person I ever longed to be close to was Joel, and I made a total mess of that. When acquaintances in the village ask me to the pub, or a party, or a barbecue, I make my excuses. I prefer my own company. Today I try to convince myself as I count napkins and swipe cobwebs out of corners that this is the reason for my growing nervousness about Kiara's impending visit. Not that I'm frightened of what she might say. Not that I'm frightened I might regret ever meeting her. While I'm peering into the fridge, wondering if the pasta salads are still safe to eat, my phone beeps with a text from Danny.
Okay if I bring Brooke along tonight.
As if I don't have enough to worry about already, with Kiara coming tomorrow. Does this mean Danny's serious about this woman? Has he told her yet that the house will be his one day? I slam the fridge door shut empty-handed. Would love to see Brooke sometime, I type. But this weekend, not really best time. Hope you agree? S. Much later, he replies. Okay, no worries. Mid-afternoon, the house is more or less visitor-ready when the doorbell rings. A van stands on the drive with the driver's door hanging open. Luckhurst Landscape Gardening, printed on the side. My surge of adrenaline doesn't recede. Ralph Luckhurst? What's he doing here?
Hi, he says.
He stands a couple of metres back from the step with his hands in his pockets. He's grown a beard since I last saw him, and its effect, in combination with his dark curls, is dramatic. He looks so much older, more serious than ever.
Sorry, I promised your gran I'd take a quick look at the back lawn, but I can do it some other time. It's just, you know, my mum asked me to check you're okay as well.
I'm fine, I say automatically, staring at him. He's like a stranger these days. He was always kind to me when we were children, but his interest in me grew more intense as the years passed. 5 years older than me, he used to wait for me outside my sixth form college when I was 17, offering to take me to the cinema or out for a drink. I said yes a few times, trying to convince myself I fancied him, trying to take my mind off Joel. Ralph had been there at the pool party and knew I'd spent the subsequent 2 years trying to avoid Joel, so when he saw us kissing at Edwin's graduation party, he assumed that Joel was harassing me and reacted accordingly. Joel left the party with a black eye, too shocked to listen to my drunken apologies. Ralph and I maintained a lopsided friendship for another year, but we drifted apart when I left for university. My romantic life has always been a disaster. Ralph squints toward the patch of damaged grass when I tell him I'm fine.
Good, he says. My mum said you looked upset the other day, that's all, but I'm glad you're fine.
He takes a step back. Warmth spreads across my cheeks as I picture myself staggering out of the doctor's office the day before yesterday. What must Helen have thought? And of course, Hayley Pickersgill would have told him about it too. His fiancée. I grip the door handle more firmly, ready to send him on his way.
I'm really sorry about your dad, he says then, his voice low.
And for a fleeting moment I glimpse Ralph as a teenager again, always ready to help anyone in need despite the constant responsibility of caring for his mother and sister. I was so angry with him after he punched Joel at Edwin's party that night, but I never doubted it was because he cared about me. He kept checking up on me in the days and weeks afterward, long after Joel had disappeared. I swing the door open wider. You might as well look at the lawn now, since you're here. He glances back at his van.
I should have rung first. I can come back at a better time.
Please. I haven't seen you in so long, and I'm going a bit crazy here on my own, to be honest. He puffs out a big breath, and his gaze runs over the upstairs windows.
Sure, okay.
I fill two glasses with cold water from the kitchen tap, and he follows me out to the patio. I settle in a chair and watch him pace out over the lawn, stooping to poke at it a couple of times. When he joins me back on the patio, he's restless, jiggling his leg as he squints out at the garden. It's bad, isn't it? I say, following his gaze. Not like when Michael Harris used to do it. I wish Vera would get rid of the current gardeners. Would you take it on, if she asked you? He clears his throat.
Actually, she thinks I should concentrate on the design side of the business in the long term, but she did cancel their contract a few days ago. That's why I'll get the lawn treated at least, while she finds someone else to take over.
Oh. I nod slowly, determined not to show him how taken aback I am that he knows more about my grandmother's plans than I do. There's a note of respect in his voice when he mentions her that makes me feel guilty for not having apologised to her after our argument last week. She's helped his family a lot over the years, and he's obviously grateful. Gran said, didn't she help find Daisy a job recently in the village?
That's right. At the baker's. She loves it.
Great, I say. We sip our drinks and stare out at the garden. I don't want to ask him about the rest of his life, about Haley and his wedding plans. I wish I hadn't invited him to sit down. He could have been on his way by now, reporting back to his mother and my grandmother. Yellow dandelion heads shiver as a breeze strokes the lawn, and an idea occurs to me. If someone sprayed normal weed killer on all this, I gesture to the scene in front of us, would it kill the grass too?
Well, you gotta use the right stuff.
What I mean is, what would kill grass? Like, burn grass? His fidgeting stops and he frowns at the lawn.
What do you mean, burn?
I mean, if you use the wrong weed killer, say, could that leave burn marks in the grass? He nods.
Yeah, of course. Or a propane torch.
What's that?
A weed burner.
He looks directly at me for the first time, his forehead creased, as if he's looking for some sign in me.
Why do you ask?
I feel as though I've missed something. Our wires are crossed. No reason, I say.
Why do you say it like that?
He settles back in his chair, his gaze still on me.
I had one stolen from my van the other day, a propane torch.
What?
Yeah, one of the tools I bought from Michael Harris, actually, when he stopped working. Joel helped him sell some of his stuff.
He says Joel's name with a slight awkwardness. I stare at him. Did you report it to the police? He studies me for a moment.
Is there something you want to confess, Seraphine?
No, I say, but I can feel the heat in my cheeks. Don't be ridiculous. What would I want with a weeding tool? He runs his hand over his beard as he glances at the lawn, and the sudden flash of amusement in his eyes triggers a stab of regret in me for our lost friendship.
Fair point, he says. No, I haven't reported it yet. I'll mention it to Martin when I see him. I was stupid. The van wasn't locked, and it's the only thing they took. I thought it was probably kids mucking around, or someone just...
His smile has gone.
Borrowed it.
He eases to his feet, the empty glass in his hand. Who would have borrowed it? I ask. He looks at his watch and grimaces.
I really need to run, sorry. Thanks for the drink.
I have to make an effort to keep up with his long strides back through the house. You're not going to answer me? I say as he opens the front door, and he turns to me with a startled expression.
What?
Who do you think might have borrowed a weed burner from you? His eyes search mine, and he leans toward me. And when he speaks, I hear the genuine concern in his voice.
I'm really very sorry about your dad, Seraphine. He was a good man. We all miss him. Just let me know if there's ever anything you need, anything I can do.
He swings round and jogs to his van. I lean against the kitchen sink for a long time, waiting to make sense of it. I've had so many off-kilter conversations this past week. Not just with Ralph, but with Laura, Pamela, Alex, Michael. Do they all know something I don't know? Do they have an agenda, an ulterior motive? Is it personal? Is it me? I don't find any answers. The clock in the hall chimes and I lift my chin, shaking off the circular thoughts. I make a cup of tea and prowl around the house, poking through the sideboard in the sitting room and browsing through the family photo albums again. I wander back toward the day nursery, an old memory niggling at me. A walk-in cupboard opens into one corner of the room, and I have to replace the light bulb inside it to get a good look at the contents. It's like a time warp in here, with the games and toys of several generations muddled together. I know what I'm looking for, and after a couple of minutes, I ease out a cardboard box, a bit bigger than a shoebox, decorated with glued-on postcards and tickets and drawings. This was Edwin's treasure box. I carry it over to the battered old nursery table. In my memory, the pictures stuck on the outside were colourful and exotic, but in the bright sunshine of this room now, they look faded and tatty. I lift the lid gingerly. There are shriveled pine cones inside and conkers, a pebble that has an S-shaped gouged into it, tickets to the pantomime, the aquarium, Madame Tussauds waxworks, train tickets, many, many train tickets, programmes for primary school productions, Edwin Mays as the innkeeper, certificates for swimming, for a spelling bee, for karate, and a bundle of cards and drawings at the bottom. I would guess Edwin stopped squirreling things away in here when he was around 7 or 8. Danny and I caught chicken pox when we were 6, and I remember Edwin digging the box out and letting us browse through its contents when we were housebound, feeling itchy and grumpy. I ease out the bundle from the bottom and flick through the drawings. Almost all of them show people, ranging from stick men to more sophisticated figures with detailed expressions. I wonder what it says about me that I used to draw Summer Bourne so obsessively when I was a child, but rarely people. Danny used to design complicated mazes. Not for the first time, I wonder how different our personalities might have been if we'd grown up with a mother. I pause at a simple drawing of two figures, one labelled with an E and the other with a T. Edwin and Theo. They each have a yellow spiral of hair. A later picture shows Daddy, Gran, Edwin, Siphon, Danny. There are several featuring Edwin and Joel surrounded by animals. There are postcards from Vera in London and from our paternal grandparents in Scotland, who died a few years ago. I open a Christmas card and read, "Dear Edwin, I'm at my own home now, but I miss you loads. Happy Christmas and I'll see you soon. Love from Laura. Kiss, 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 kiss." I check all the others. There's no further mention of Laura and none of Alex. Just before 9 in the evening, I hear a car on the drive. I'm tempted to run out and tell them all about the burned grass and the lipstick message, but I steel myself against it. Edwin and Danny make a noisy entrance, dropping bags onto the floor I cleaned earlier, scattering possessions over the kitchen countertops I'd so diligently cleared. I grit my teeth.
"You told me you were coming straight back here,"
is the first thing Danny says to me.
"Alex bloody Kymal, what the hell's got into you?"
"At least I'm doing something," I snap back. "I need to know what happened that day." Edwin holds up his hands between us.
"Hey, you got beer in for us, thanks," he says, grabbing a bottle and pulling the bottle opener from the drawer.
"Joel brought them, actually," I say.
"Is he coming tonight?"
Edwin asks. I shake my head. Danny opens 2 more bottles and passes one to me.
"Come on then, spill."
"Come and see what I found first." They follow me through to the day nursery. The sun is setting and the pink and gold light bathes the contents of Edwin's treasure box laid out on the table. It's a strangely beautiful scene, and yet for some reason makes me wish I had never unearthed these memories. Or perhaps just makes me wish that Dad was still alive and we were gathered here for happy reasons. Edwin moves forward with a murmur of recognition.
"I haven't seen these for years. Where did you find it? Look at these."
He shuffles through the cards and the tickets, holding a couple of them up to show Danny.
"I remember this,"
Danny says.
I started my own treasure box, but I could never be bothered to collect things for it.
I lean my shoulder lightly against his as we watch Edwin leafing through his old drawings.
That's you two,
Edwin says, holding up a brightly coloured picture, flying on gigantic birds.
Of course, Danny murmurs.
Edwin pauses at another one and then places it separately on the table and stares at it. I recognise it from earlier. A bird with a beak and legs and spindly toes, and a person lying next to it with a sad face. Unusually, it's all in black crayon, except for a red patch on the bird's body.
Theo and the robin,
Edwin says quietly. My eyes widen.
What robin?
Danny asks.
I don't know,
Edwin says, slowly shaking his head.
Gran said something about it that day, on the cliffs.
Robin was Mum's twin brother, I say. He died before he was born. The cord was wrapped around his neck. They stare at me.
How did you...
Edwin says. Pamela told me. She also told me... I feel lightheaded suddenly. I can't say it aloud to my brothers. That twins never survive at Summerbourn. That's why Theo died. That no one in the village believes we're the real Summerbourn twins. I take a deep breath. Look, it doesn't matter. I'm glad you're here. I just hope Kiara can tell us something useful tomorrow, that's all. Edwin and Danny watch me. I concentrate on keeping my breathing calm, conscious of the other secrets I'm keeping from them. The letters burned into the lawn, the writing on the mirror. Edwin sighs.
What time is she coming?
About 12.
And then you'll come back with us for a Winterbourn lunch on Sunday, yes?
I nod, pressing my nails into my palms. Edwin is fiddling with the layers of tickets and postcards glued to the box lid, and he suddenly sits up straighter, ripping a train ticket off completely.
Look at this.
He gives a short laugh. Freshly revealed is a flimsy grey square of shiny paper with a grainy white pattern on it. He peels it off the box and bends over it for a moment, then pushes it across the table toward us. It's an ultrasound image. With Ruth Mays and 10 February 1992 printed across the top. And it shows a baby. One baby. Goosebumps spring up along my arms. Danny and I look at each other and then back at the scan picture. Which of us is it?
Shit,
says Danny. I don't believe it, I whisper. We stare at it in silence.
Can you get individual pictures of twin babies?
Danny asks eventually. I rub my hands over my face.
I don't know. We could ask Joel.
Why did you have this?
Danny asks Edwin.
Did Mum give it to you?
Edwin shrugs.
I guess so.
Would you remember if there were two pictures of two babies? I ask.
Oh, Seraphine, I don't know,
Edwin says. Without further discussion, we abandon the table strewn with Edwin's memories and carry our beers through to the sitting room where we slump on the sofas.
Is there shopping coming in the morning then?
Edwin asks eventually. Yeah, between 9 and 10. I ordered stuff for risotto, if you don't mind cooking. I pause, trying to picture the four of us sitting around the dining table eating lunch, piecing together clues. I should have told Joel to come before 12 if he wants to see you. Can you text him and say? Edwin nods.
I can't believe she's driving all this way because her dad used to know our parents,
Danny mutters. Then he sighs and pats me on the arm.
Anyway, I'm sorry, sis, he says. I can see you've got it bad.
What?
Mentionitis, Danny says, shaking his head. Edwin says,
Danny.
In a warning tone, I narrow my eyes at my twin brother. I have no clue what you're on about, Danny.
Mentionitis with Joel. You've mentioned him at least 15 times since we arrived.
Oh, shut up, idiot. I whack him with a cushion. He's laughing and I can feel my cheeks reddening. But I'm suddenly reminded of something else. Hang on. Truce.
I need to ask you both something. Danny groans. I look at Edwin. You remember that day by the pool, when you had that party with your university friends, and Joel called us sprites? I ask. Edwin raises his eyebrows. Danny just blinks at me.
Yeah,
Edwin says eventually.
It was 10 years ago, but yeah, of course I remember.
What happened after I left? I look from one to the other. Did Joel get hurt? Edwin tilts his head back against the sofa and looks at the ceiling. Danny's gaze slides sideways and he waits.
You knocked a glass off the table as you ran away, Edwin says quietly. Deliberately, it looked like. Maybe not. I don't know. A piece of glass flew up and cut Joel under his chin.
I stare at him. The air feels too thick.
I never knew that. It was an accident.
They're both quiet.
So what happened then? Did he need stitches?
We got Michael. Edwin rolls his head forward again. The nanny would have made a fuss. Michael took Joel to the doctor. He got stitched up. It was fine. Lots of blood, though, Danny says.
I look at the bottle of beer in my hand and slowly place it on the coffee table.
Why didn't you tell me? Nobody ever told me.
Edwin sighs, and Danny makes a small noise in his throat.
You always turned everything into a drama, Seth, Danny says, his gentle tone at odds with the weight of the words. Who knows how you'd have reacted? You spent the rest of that summer hiding from Joel anyway, and biting our heads off if we tried to talk to you about it. It was generally easier not to tell you stuff like that.
The fact that neither of my brothers adds, it still is, merely deepens the silence that follows.
20. Laura, January to March 1992. Thera began to visit more frequently in the new year, at least once and sometimes twice a week. Each time she arrived, she found an excuse to take me out of Ruth's earshot and ask, "How is she?" I felt sick at being put on the spot like that, unwilling as I was to describe Ruth's odd behaviour, yet reluctant to lie that everything was fine. I began to dread her visits. Ruth took Edwin to his first settling-in session at the preschool. The following day, I heard her on the phone, cancelling his place for the rest of the term. "Thank you so much. We'll try again after Easter." She didn't mention a reason to me, and I didn't ask. She hired a man to come and paint the day nursery, and then after he had moved all the furniture and covered it in dust sheets, she sent him away, claiming she couldn't bear the smell of the paint. Privately, she told me, "I didn't like his eyes. I didn't trust him." She spent 10 minutes chatting at the front door with a red-haired traveller woman one afternoon, allowing the warm air of the house to be sucked out into the January gloom, and she bought a pair of beautiful glass candlesticks from her. Afterward, she smashed the candlesticks in the kitchen sink, grinding the glass with a rolling pin and flushing it down the drain. Yet frequently, she was seized by buoyant moods. She sang as she pottered around the kitchen, making up nonsense words to entertain Edwin, She stopped taking him to gymnastics, but she often joined us on the beach despite the cold weather, and we'd all have hot chocolate together on our return to the house. I might have told all of this to Dominic, but he never asked. He had a wary manner about him those days, sometimes watching me without seeming to actually see me. "I know you've been discussing me with Mother behind my back again," I heard Ruth say to him. "You both use identical phrases. It's pathetic. I'm fine. We are fine. I'm having my scan on the 11th of February, and I'm happy with my doctor. You've got to let me do this my way, Dominic. Trust me to know what's best for my baby."
"Our baby,"
Dominic said, and then I heard her weeping and him murmuring soothing words. I agreed to look after Edwin from a Sunday evening until a Tuesday evening, so that Dominic could take Ruth down to London for a couple of days and accompany her to her scan. On the Monday afternoon, I had Edwin and Joel kneeling on chairs at the kitchen table, stirring cake mixture, when a taxi pulled up on the drive. For a minute, I thought it was going to be Alex. I hovered in the kitchen doorway, watching through the hall window, waiting for him to step out and look up, and perhaps catch my eye. But it was Ruth who emerged, handing money to the driver, marching up to the front door with a broad smile on her face. "Guess what?" she said, bustling in and shedding her coat, checking her hair in the mirror. "It's just one baby, and all is well." Edwin galloped from the kitchen to wrap his arms around her middle, and Joel hung back in the doorway, a streak of flour on his cheek. "Well, that's wonderful," I said. "I thought your scan was tomorrow." "Oh, it was, but I popped in this morning, and they said they could do it today. I couldn't say no. It was so magical to see it, him or her. I must ring Dominic straight away and tell him." I brushed the flour from Joel's cheek and ushered both boys back into the kitchen. "Could Dominic not go with you then?" "No, like I said, it was a spur of the moment thing." She licked her lips. "Would you like to see the scan picture?" I looked properly into her eyes for the first time. A suspicion that she might not have actually had a scan had been unfurling inside me, and I hadn't anticipated this offer of proof. But she was already reaching into her handbag, pulling out a little square image, handing it to me. I held it gingerly. It showed a fuzz of white on black and had Ruth's name and the date at the top. She leaned over it, her hair beneath my chin. "That's the head," she said, "and that's the backbone. The legs are up there, and that's part of an arm, you see?" "It's amazing. You could see the little heart beating," she said. "It was perfect. And, you know, I thought I might be disappointed it's not twins, but I think it will be easier this way." "Yes," I said, blinking unexpected tears away. My only personal experience of a twin relationship was a decidedly negative one. My mum's virtually estranged sister, whose occasional postcards from exotic locations made my mum scowl. So it was ridiculous to feel sad for Edwin, sad for this new sibling of his.
"And you don't know if it's a boy or a girl?"
"No, I don't want to know. I want to meet this baby when he or she is ready to be met. Enjoy the moment." I nodded.
"And did they tell you a due date?"
She froze. I bit my lip. When she eventually moved, it was to twitch the picture from my grasp. "End of August," she said, and then looked at me.
"Okay.
I need to ring Dominic. Would you mind getting back to the boys?"
"Of course."
I closed the kitchen door, not wanting to hear any of that conversation. Later, when Edwin and I had returned from delivering both Joel and a box of fairy cakes safely to Michael's cottage, Ruth showed Edwin the scan picture.
"That's your baby brother or sister," she said, smiling.
He wrinkled his nose at it.
"It's not very good."
"The baby will look much nicer when he or she is born, I promise," she said.
"I'm going to paint a picture of my baby," Edwin said,
heading off to the day nursery with the picture.
I'll stick this on my treasure box.
Good idea, darling, Ruth said. I must have looked surprised, because after he'd gone, she added in a slightly defensive tone, Dominic can still see it when he gets home. It's my baby at the moment. Once it's born, he'll fall in love with it, and everything will be fine. She went upstairs to have a rest. Later that afternoon, it began to snow heavily, and for a number of days, the three of us didn't leave the grounds of Summerbourne. On the eve of Valentine's Day, Ruth made much fuss at the discovery of a parcel of sweets on the doorstep. Oh, Edwin, look! Jack Valentine has left us a present! She and Edwin were in high spirits that evening, eating the sweets and peering out of the windows to look for footprints in the snow from the mysterious gift giver. I had to confess that Jack Valentine had never ventured as far as my home in London, but evidently, here he was just as important as Father Christmas and the Tooth Fairy. Ruth begged Dominic not to risk driving on the icy roads to get home for the weekend, and in the end, he agreed to stay in the city. Snowed in for several days at Summerbourne, we made popcorn and watched movies and built snowmen, raiding the freezer for fish fingers and pizzas, going to bed early and getting up late. On the day the snow finally melted, I had to suppress a twinge of disappointment that our mini holiday was at an end. But the Summerbourne woods had never looked more beautiful than on that day. Snowdrops huddled in clumps on either side of the path, and the dark skeletons of the plum trees showed off delicate white blossoms against the palest of grey skies, promising that spring was on its way. When Dominic returned the following Friday evening, he was full of plans for booking a real holiday for the three of them before the baby came. I don't want to go abroad, Ruth said, and I don't want to leave it too close to my due date, and I'd rather take Laura too, to help with Edwin. I was in the kitchen with them, but I abandoned my washing up and moved to the door, avoiding eye contact with Dominic.
Wait, he said. Laura, it's not that I don't want you to come.
He turned toward Ruth again.
I just think it would be nice to be just the three of us. Special.
Ruth sighed, and Dominic shot me a pleading look. I rested a hand on the doorframe.
I could do with a week at home, to study, I said.
Well then,
Dominic said, turning back to Ruth.
There you go. Let's take a look at the Centre Parks brochure.
As it turned out, I went home to Mum's for longer than originally planned. Edwin came down with a cold and a cough, and then Ruth and I both caught it. It left me feeling drained and lethargic, and I spent 3 weeks recuperating at Mum's, during which time Ruth, Dominic and Edwin had their holiday. Thankfully, Beaky went down to Kent for a couple of weeks on a job, so Mum and I got along better than we had for ages, but I still kept to my room for much of the time. A certain reluctance to return to Summerbourne began to grow in me. I wasn't sure I could summon enough energy to face more of Ruth's mood swings, Dominic's awkwardness, or the ridiculous jolt of desperate hope I felt every time the doorbell rang, wondering if it might be Alex. I browsed local job adverts and considered applying for part-time waitressing or bar work.
But I thought you loved it there,
Mum asked when she caught me underlining phone numbers in the local paper.
I do, I did. But this would bring in money too, and I could pay you rent. I could study at home then, for these last few weeks.
You don't need to pay rent, love.
Beaky thinks I do.
Mum sighed.
He just wants you to learn to take responsibility for yourself. I slammed the paper onto the coffee table and stood up. I made one mistake. How long do I need to keep paying for it?
He just thinks.
I don't care what he thinks.
I glared at her.
You sound just like him, you know that?
I barricaded myself into my bedroom for the rest of the afternoon, shoving Beaky's wine boxes up against the door. I half hoped Mum might attempt to coax me out, but she didn't. I pulled out the resignation letter I'd written to Ruth and Dominic that morning, and it trembled in my hand as I read it through. I hadn't signed or dated it yet.
When Beaky got back a few days later, I turned up the television volume to drown out the noise of him ranting to Mum in the kitchen. He stalked in and turned the set off with a snarl.
"We're not a hotel. You're well enough to work. You need to go back and get on with it."
His lip curled as he looked me up and down.
"Your mum says you've barely moved since you got here. I thought you were going to get fit at this posh mansion, playing tennis all day with your snobby friends. Got fed up of you, did they?"
I rang Summerbourne that evening and headed back the next day. The unsigned resignation letter remained tucked at the back of my biology ring binder. I dozed on the train, but my spirits lifted as the taxi approached the house. Edwin burst from the front door and flung himself into my arms with a whoop of joy. "He's been rather difficult," Ruth told me a few minutes later, out of the little boy's earshot.
"More than ready to go to school," Dominic said.
Ruth gave my arm a quick squeeze. "It's good to have you back." She smiled, and I was sure then that I had made the right decision in returning. My life was tied up with Summerbourne now. It was in my blood. It wasn't the sort of connection I could just walk away from. When I found Ruth sobbing over a box of baby clothes a few days later, distressed by the mould that had bloomed on them in the attic, I took charge. I rang Vera and arranged for her to come and look after Edwin the following day, and Ruth and I went shopping in Norwich together. After months of baking and curling up indoors, with no daily training sessions at the pool anymore, I had lost the sharp angles I'd arrived at Summerbourne with. When I looked in the mirror, I was pleased that I no longer had dark smudges under my eyes, and I relished the idea of buying some new clothes and makeup, and perhaps even a floppy sun hat to match Ruth's. Ruth and I spent a happy couple of hours trying on clothes, and then cooing over rompers and choosing a whole new set of essential nursery items. Ruth bought us coffee and cake in the department store restaurant afterward. "Thank you for doing this," she said. "It's been fun. I can't wait to find out if it's a boy or a girl now." She gave me a sudden, intense look. "You will stay with us the whole summer, won't you? After the baby comes? It'll be perfect. Lazy days in the garden, down to the beach every day. We must make the most of it before Edwin starts school and you have to leave us." My last forkful of cake hovered over the plate as I glanced around at the bags and boxes of baby equipment surrounding us. And then I smiled at her. "Sounds like we have the perfect summer ahead," I said. And she returned my smile, her hand drifting down to her gently rounded abdomen. But that last mouthful of cake turned to glue on my tongue. I forced it down with the dregs of my tea, determined to be optimistic about the next few months. Ruth's baby would have a great father in Dominic. Dominic might become less awkward with me. Alex might come back to Summerbourne. I placed the cup carefully down on the saucer and leaned forward to admire a tiny cardigan that Ruth had pulled from one of the carrier bags. "Alex might come back to Summerbourne." "Are you okay?" Ruth asked. "Yeah, fine," I said, "worn out from all that shopping." She laughed and turned to catch the attention of a staff member, asking him to carry our purchases out to the car for us. And all the while my insides squirmed, as if a sea serpent was rearranging its coils inside me.
21. Seraphine. Edwin and I unpacked the grocery bags together on Saturday morning. As ever, the effect the fresh ingredients have on him is powerful. He smiles as he rubs his thumbs over the onions, flexes the celery, sniffs at the parmesan, and inspects the prawns. He's in his element, relaxed and happy. At moments like this, he reminds me so much of Dad. Danny is still in bed. I set out cutlery and glasses on the old red tablecloth in the dining room, fussing with napkins, irritated by my inability to be calm like my brother's. I'm wearing a new cotton dress, but I can't find my sandals that go with it. And when the doorbell rings, I answer it barefoot, distracted. Joel stands there with a bunch of hydrangeas.
From Michael's garden, he says, for the table.
Oh.
Everything okay?
I realised I haven't moved. When I reach for the flowers, our fingers brush against each other and I come close to blurting out a jumble of questions. Did you really not know Michael has a key for Summerbourne? Why didn't you hit Ralph back at Edwin's party after I kissed you? Did you know Michael's old weed torch was stolen from Ralph's van last week? What did you mean when you said we could start over? As friends? As more than friends? Edwin's in there, I say, indicating the kitchen door, and I escape to the dining room with the hydrangeas. The pink flower heads are full and heavy, droplets of water still clinging to their petals. A wave of nostalgia washes over me for Summerbourne's formerly beautiful garden, for the days when Michael ruled over it with cheerful authority, and for a time when Joel and I were friends and life was uncomplicated. A whole hour before she's expected, Kiara arrives. I happen to be passing through the hall still barefoot, and I freeze, watching her through the window as she unfolds herself from the driver's seat. She wears some kind of silky black sleeveless jumpsuit and delicate-heeled sandals which must surely make driving difficult. She's tall and slender, and I realise the word I'm really searching for is elegant. I swallow. Danny has come down the stairs behind me in old shorts and T-shirt, bleary-eyed, and he whistles now as he peers through the window past the visitor.
Nice wheels.
Edwin is at the kitchen door, with Joel standing behind him, both watching curiously. When the doorbell rings, Danny gives me a shove in the small of my back.
Your idea, sis,
he says. I take a deep breath as I swing the door open. Kiara, hi. I do my best to smile at her. Her hair is how I remember, with the pink streak to one side. But up close, I am transfixed by the tiny diamond stud in the side of her nose and the rows of similar sparkles in her ears. She thrusts a box of Belgian chocolates at me. Hi. I'm sorry I'm so early. I allowed extra time and then the roads were so clear. She sounds nervous and I'm not proud of the fact that this helps me relax a little. I turn around as she steps into the hall, ready to make introductions. I glimpse Edwin passing the vegetable knife he was holding to Joel, who places it carefully on the countertop behind him. They move properly into the hall then, too. This is Danny, I say. My twin brother.
All right,
Danny says, and Kiara smiles and nods at him. And this is Edwin, our older brother, I say. Edwin reaches out a hand and shakes hers.
Pleased to meet you. I remember your father. I liked him a lot, he says.
Her smile widens.
Hi.
And this is Joel, a neighbour, I say. He's not staying. Edwin coughs as Joel shakes Kiara's hand too.
Nice to meet you, Joel tells her.
Is her gaze lingering on his face? Does he think she's attractive? I'm regretting this visit already.
Well, I don't know about anyone else, but I need coffee, Danny announces. Would you like one, Kiara?
She smiles at him. I'd love one. She follows him through to the kitchen. As Edwin joins them, I stand alone for a minute in the hall with Joel, listening to the polite chatter between my easygoing brothers and this stranger. I don't look at Joel directly, but he watches me, a serious expression on his face. In the end, he steps closer and touches the back of my hand with his fingertips, and finally I do look at him.
Good luck,
he says, with the briefest of smiles, and then he leaves. Edwin has resumed his chopping of ingredients when I enter the kitchen. Danny is pouring milk into coffee mugs, and Kiara is studying the old photos on the corkboard.
It must have been lovely, growing up with so much family history around you, she says.
She sounds wistful, but as I gaze around at the worn surfaces in our kitchen, the battered wooden doors of the cupboards, the chipped tiles on the floor, I have a sudden mental image of her standing in a pristine, high-tech kitchen in her own home this morning, white marble and stainless steel glinting all around her.
Family history's not all it's cracked up to be, I mutter into a pocket of silence.
And they all stare at me. No one replies. The kitchen doors are open, since it's another hot, cloudless day, and the three of us take our coffees out onto the patio while Edwin begins to cook the risotto.
Such a fabulous garden, Kiara says,
seeming genuinely enraptured. And for a moment, I'm able to ignore the scruffy grass and neglected borders and appreciate the beauty of it alongside her. We stroll along the paths and show her the orchard, the vegetable garden, our old play areas and the gate to the cliffs. We offer to take her down to the beach later. We carefully avoid the subject of our parents until we're back indoors with Edwin, seated around the dining table, tucking into our lunch. The hydrangea heads droop toward the tablecloth in the heat.
This is divine, Kiara says of the risotto. And I wish I didn't have such a strange reason for being here. But can you tell me why you came to see my father?
She looks directly at me, and I put my fork down carefully, wipe my mouth. The day that Danny and I were born, I say, our mother had a mental breakdown. We don't know quite what happened, but she ended up committing suicide, jumping from the cliffs behind the house. We were only a few hours old. Kiara brings one hand to her mouth.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
Yeah, well, our dad only ever worked part-time after that, and we had our grandmother and various nannies here to look after us, so it was okay. I try to smile. I mean, we had one another, you know? But then Dad had an accident last month. He fell off a ladder and he died. A freak accident. Danny is sitting next to me, and he slides a hand over mine under the table. I realise all three of them are watching me, and that my brothers are waiting for my explanation with as much wariness as Kiara. Why did I go to see her father? I draw in a deep breath. I think our mother might only have had one baby that summer. I found a photo of her holding just one baby, and people always said, there were always rumours when we were growing up that something odd happened. And there was a girl working here at the time, Laura Silveira, who I thought might be able to tell us. Do you know the name? Kiara shakes her head slowly.
She's the woman you accused Dad of sending a letter to.
I didn't accuse him. I asked him.
But he didn't, Kiara says.
Someone sent Laura a letter after our dad died, saying that if she spoke about Summerborn to anyone, her daughter would be in danger, I say.
Who is her daughter?
Kiara asks. We all look at her. At her willowy frame, her cheekbones, the texture of her hair. I've seen Laura's olive skin and Alex's brown, and this young woman is paler than either of them. But what does that prove? I shake my head. We don't know.
You think it might be me? Kiara asks, frowning. Or you?
She adds, staring at me.
I don't understand.
I'll get the photo, I say. Hang on. I rise and head to the kitchen, and for a moment I contemplate the doors that stand open to the garden. I could walk out right now, escape to the cliffs, abandon any further conversation with Kiara,
set my sights on rescuing my old life, what's left of my old life. A faint waft of humid air reminds me that it's even hotter out there than it is here in the house. I turn to the sink and run my wrists under cold water until my head feels clearer. And then I return to the dining room with the photo and pass it to Chiara. That's our mother, with one of us, presumably me or Danny, with her new baby anyway. Apparently, she was convinced before she died that someone was trying to steal her baby. I give a short laugh. And yet, they ended up with two of us. Chiara scrutinizes the picture. You look like her, she tells me. You look like your mother. I feel tears well up suddenly. Thank you, I whisper. Danny shifts on his chair. So, what did your dad tell you about your mum? He asks Chiara. When were you born? She passes the photo back to me carefully. 21st of July, 1992, she says. The three of us stare at her. She stiffens. What? That's... Danny shakes his head. Edwin pushes his chair back a little, putting his hands on the table as if about to get up, but then he stays in that position, his face turned away. I manage to start breathing again. That's our birthday, I say eventually. Danny and I were born that day too. Chiara looks around the room, up at the ceiling, back down again. Oh. There's a long silence. Okay, Danny says eventually. So, we were all born on the same day. What do you know about your mum? Chiara closes her eyes for a moment. She died soon after I was born, she says, her tone flat, as if she's reciting. In India. My dad brought me to England when I was very young, used my Indian birth certificate to get me a British birth certificate, since he's British. I've looked at both the certificates many times, but my mother's name on the Indian document is smudged, illegible, and the British document says unverified. He says he loved her, but it hurts too much to talk about her. Edwin turns to stare at her, his eyes wide. Was she Indian? Danny asks. Your mother? No, British too. So why were you born there? Danny asks. Chiara shrugs. I wonder sometimes whether I really was. It seems a convenient story. Edwin says, I used to call your father Uncle Alex. I'm sure he used to visit us here the year you were born. I remember him being here with Laura. He never brought a girlfriend or a wife here that I remember. He was friends with Laura, I say. They took you to the doctor once, Edwin, when you cut yourself. Do you remember? Pamela Larch told me. Edwin looks at me blankly, but Chiara sits forward. Is that why you wanted to talk to him? Because he was a friend of Laura's? She asks. I nod. I thought Laura might have told him something about us after she left here, or they might still be in touch and maybe he could persuade her to talk to me. I thought he might know something. I didn't know he had his own daughter and his own secrets. So, let's get this straight, Chiara says, and we sit up a little in our chairs in response to her tone. Your mother had a baby on the 21st of July 1992. So did my mother. Your mother believed someone wanted to steal her baby. You were brought up as your mother's twins, but you don't think you can be. We're all watching her. I'm holding my breath. She pauses. Okay, all three of us were born on the same day. Your parents had one baby, but acquired a second one. Or possibly your mother had one baby that was stolen, then acquired two more. Both of our mothers died around the same time.
unless your mother was my mother. She looks from me to Danny.
But I look nothing like the lady in the photo, and that would leave both of you with no known parents, and yet you do both look like your parents.
Her shoulders slump. She shakes her head in defeat.
Well, I'm glad we sorted that out, Danny says.
I glare at him, and then Kiara pulls a face, and then Edwin snorts, and suddenly we're all kind of laughing, united in our bafflement.
We could be triplets, Kiara says.
Your mum's baby was stolen and my mum gave her two of her triplets.
She's holding up her hands now, searching for inspiration.
Was there a pregnant neighbour, a distant relative, an orphanage nearby?
I know we're old-fashioned out here in the countryside, but we weren't born in the 19th century, Danny protests. There's no workhouse in the village.
Kiara smiles, then shrugs.
I give up then.
Edwin stands up.
Can you hear something?
We listen, and I do hear someone shouting, behind the house somewhere. We follow Edwin out through the kitchen and onto the patio. Two figures stumble from the trees at the back of the lawn.
It's Joel,
Edwin says, and starts to run. Danny and I follow at a trot, leaving Kiara standing on the patio. I'm halfway across the lawn before I realise that the person Joel is supporting is Laura.
What on earth is she doing here?
As I get closer, I see blood on her head and her blouse, and blood on Joel's shoulder and hands.
Call an ambulance,
Joel shouts. I stumble as I look down at my dress. No pockets, no phone. Edwin, who is closer to them, turns toward us, and Danny nods at him, spins around, and sprints back toward the house.
What happened?
I ask as I reach them. Edwin supports Laura on her other side, and the two men lift her between them and carry her toward the house. Laura's eyes are almost closed, but she's moving her lips. She's dazed and distressed and not fully conscious.
I found her by the folly, Joel says, panting with the effort of supporting her.
He has a smear of blood on the side of his face.
Head trauma. Need to get her to hospital.
It's Laura,
I say to Edwin, stupidly, keeping pace with them. He grimaces, looking as if he might say something, and then shaking his head. Danny finishes speaking into his phone as we reach the patio, and he and Kiara lift a table to one side so that Joel and Edwin can manoeuvre Laura around into a sitting position on one of the sofas. Laura's eyes are more open now, and she's making an effort to focus on our faces, her head smearing blood across the cream cushion as she turns it from side to side.
Can you get me a clean tea towel?
Joel asks, and I run and grab one from the kitchen drawer.
Shh! Keep still,
Joel says to Laura, folding the fabric and holding it over her wound. Laura has fixed her gaze on Edwin now. She says his name questioningly, but it's a raspy croak. He kneels down in front of her.
Laura.
He tries to smile.
What happened?
She shakes her head and winces.
I don't know. I think something fell on me from the top of the tower.
She looks around and her fingers twitch toward me.
Seraphine.
I take her hand and squeeze it gently.
What are you doing here, Laura?
I ask, but she doesn't respond. She's gazing at Danny and Kiara, who are standing side by side behind the table. A fresh trickle of blood runs down her cheek as she tries to sit forward, and my heart thumps painfully.
Stop asking questions or lose your family.
Someone attacked this woman just behind our house.
Is this the danger I have put my own family in?
Could Edwin or Danny or Vera be next? Or me?
A single strident note sounds from the lane, and Joel hurries into the house to open the door for the paramedics. Laura moans and leans her head back against the cushion. One hand closes over the silver locket hanging around her neck. The rest of us exchange wide-eyed looks.
Who did this?
I ask. Edwin, Danny, and Kiara shake their heads with bewildered expressions. Joel returns with the paramedics, and we stand back as they bustle around, easing Laura onto a stretcher, asking her gentle questions. She murmurs something, but she doesn't open her eyes again. As they start to carry her away, I pick up a folded piece of paper that has fallen from her trouser pocket, holding it out toward their retreating backs, but there's no point trying to give it to Laura in this state. I decide to keep it and return it to her when she's recovered. I hear Joel offering to accompany her in the ambulance, but they say no. The police are on their way and will want to talk to him. We all stand and watch as the ambulance pulls out of the drive and rumbles off down the lane. Joel turns to me then, calm despite the blood that covers him.
Do you mind if I get cleaned up?
He asks, and I gesture to the stairs. Edwin goes up with him to lend him some clean clothes. As I trail after Danny and Kiara, who are wandering back to the patio, I unfold the note from Laura's pocket. My eyes skip down to the name at the bottom, and my heart jolts painfully. I read it through twice, quickly, trying to make sense of it. Dear Laura, I desperately need your help. Please will you meet me at midday on Saturday at the Folly at Summerbourne? I will explain everything then, but you know I would not ask unless I really needed you. Come the back way from the boat hire place. I'll meet you by the tower. Yours, Edwin. Edwin, my big brother, who is upstairs finding clean clothes for his best friend, Joel. His best friend, Joel, who would do anything for him and who left our house before midday today and returned covered in Laura's blood.
22. Laura. March to July, 1992. The garden, the lane, the village. Wherever I walked that March, I was faced with the nodding yellow heads of daffodils, promising more cheerful times to come. Everyone in the village predicted that Ruth would start to bloom soon. Surely, they said, she deserved a few months of radiant well-being before this pregnancy was over. They were wrong. She suffered aches and twinges. She slept badly by night and napped resentfully by day. She was prone to outbursts of tears and occasionally hysterical laughter. Meanwhile, Edwin's behaviour deteriorated, with frequent tantrums and wild declarations that nobody loved him. Even on good days he took to whining when he didn't get his own way. All three of us had coughs and colds again through April, and much as I wanted to get Edwin outside to play every day, it was frequently impossible, due to either wet weather or the fact that we felt too unwell. We baked biscuits and cakes when we felt up to it, the warm, steamy atmosphere in the kitchen soothing our symptoms as we waited for the oven timer to ping. Even a stroll into the village to collect a prescription or to choose treats to cheer ourselves up felt like an effort. There was no further mention of Edwin attending preschool after Easter, but as the weather grew warmer in May and Michael increased his hours in the Summerbourne garden, we began to see more of Joel again. Only Joel could bring that deep chuckle out of Edwin and make his blue eyes sparkle with mischief, and I begged Michael to bring him over as often as he could. Kemi, Joel's mother, wanted him with her on the days she didn't work, but this left us with a pattern of 3 days a week where Joel spent the afternoon with us, and Edwin's mood improved enormously. I withdrew from most of their family activities at weekends, claiming that I wanted to study for my exams. I returned to Mum's for the exam fortnight, and for once Beaky left me in peace to concentrate on my final preparations. I'd dreamed of a career in scientific research since I was at primary school, and I needed an A and 2 B grades to get onto my chosen biochemistry degree course. The math and biology papers went well, and the chemistry practical wasn't as hard as I'd expected. I headed back to Summerbourne, cautiously confident that I'd achieve my grades. Despite no longer having the studying excuse, I continued to avoid family meals at weekends. On Saturdays, I caught the bus into Norwich, spending some of my accumulated pay on clothes and makeup, and going to the cinema by myself. When I grew bored of this, I sat in the city library and immersed myself in a novel for hours without interruption. It was refreshing to see different faces around me, even if they were all strangers. It was during one of those library visits that I hunted out a book with a lunar calendar. Sure enough, June had 2 new moons that year, one on the 1st of the month, which I had already missed, and then another on the 30th of the month, the black moon that Dominic had mentioned. It was only when I examined the diagrams that I understood there would be nothing to see. A new moon has its sunlit face turned completely away from us. It would indeed appear black in the dark night sky, as invisible up there as I frequently felt down here on the ground. The black moon was on my mind as I made a second round of toast for myself and Edwin on that last day in June. The sky was a glorious blue, the sun cheerful, and I felt better than I had done in months. We devoured several slices of toast and marmalade between us. "Guess what?" I said. "It's a special day today. Something's going to happen that